Radio.
Family and Work in 21st Century Australia. A talk by Joe DeBrine.
So I want to speak about the union that I've worked for and its development of a policy on the family and on marriage over time. But before starting that, I just want to say a few things by way of introduction. I worked for the union for 41 and a half years, from April 1973 until October last year when I retired from full-time work. Now, the SDA, as I call the union, is a union that covers the retail industry primarily. And so that you understand the people who are members of this union, it is the largest union in Australia. It's got well over 200,000 members, and that is out of a total unionised workforce of about 1.7 million. So about 12% of all the unionised workforce in the country is a member of the SDA. So we're a large and obviously successful union. A person working in the retail industry full-time today earns $37,500 gross a year. Now, I wanted to say that because these are low-income people. Full-time in the retail industry, the minimum rate is $37,500. And you might say, well, that must be just about the minimum wage. No, it's not. You should understand that the minimum wage in this country is $65 per week less than what a shop assistant earns. So we're talking about low-income people who have to try to make their way in our society. The second thing I want to say by way of introduction is that in my 41 and a half years of working full-time for the union, I would have spent 99.9% of my time negotiating and arguing for the members of the union about their wages, their working conditions, their job security, health and safety issues, security and retirement, workplace grievances, and so on. The issues that I'm talking about tonight would only ever have taken up 0.1% of my time over that period, if that. So that's putting it into a context. I have been a union official all my life. That is what I've done. The things I'm going to talk about, which obviously are very important, have actually occupied only a tiny fraction of my time, and you wouldn't get that impression if you go by what the media says. So I want to talk about how the union has come logically over a long period of time to its current policy on the family and marriage. It all started 40 years ago, in 1975, soon after I had started with the union. The union at the time decided to appoint a national women's officer for the first time. Now, again, you need to understand the context. 1 July 1975 was the date at which equal pay for women became compulsory throughout the workforce. Some people had achieved equal pay before then, but it was between 1972 and 1975 that the vast majority of women in the workforce achieved equal pay by virtue of a decision of what is now called the Fair Work Commission. Now, we as a union have about 60% of our membership female, and at the time and in that environment of just having achieved equal pay, we thought it was appropriate to appoint a national women's officer to deal with the special issues of women workers at the workplace. And out of that appointment came, as you would expect, a women's policy for the SDA. In talking to members, there were lots of issues at the workplace which went into the development of a women's policy. But what our National Women's Officer found, as she went around talking to the rank and file members, was that women in the workforce had concerns in addition to their concerns at work. They were working for a reason, which was primarily not for a career, but primarily to provide for dependents back home. Some of them were obviously supplementing a family income from the main breadwinner. But there were also others who were single parents, and they were providing and the sole breadwinners for the dependents that they had. And so they had concerns beyond the workplace. They had concerns about their income and how much was left after tax that they took home to provide for their family. So in addition to developing a women's policy, we logically found ourselves developing a family policy as well. Now, this family policy wasn't all put together in one go. It was something that developed year by year as new issues arose. And the story tonight really is about the logical development of that policy over time. In the 1980s, there were three standout issues that we faced, which were all about family income. Now, given that our members were low income and what they took home was very important to them, these three issues were all important to our members. The first one was when Paul Keating, as treasurer in about 1984 or 1985, proposed a 15% consumption tax. Now, a consumption tax is back on the agenda today with proposals that our GST should be increased from 10% to 15% and that it should be widened to cover goods and services which today are exempt. From the point of view of low-income people who spend virtually all the money they earn each week on providing for their families, a GST is something that they cannot avoid. It is a regressive tax because it imposes a far greater burden on low-income people than it does on high-income people. High-income people spend some of their money, but they also have the ability to save, and so they do. So the proportion of the income of a low-income person that is collected in the GST is higher than the proportion of the income of a higher-income person. And therefore, it is a regressive tax. So we opposed Keating's consumption tax proposal. We argued very hard and very publicly, and in the end, it was withdrawn. That was good. The second issue that we took up at that time was on family allowances. Malcolm Fraser in the 1970s had changed the child endowment system and introduced family allowances, and it had been set at a relatively generous level at that time. However, there was no mechanism for increasing it over time. And of course, the 1970s and the 1980s were a period of much higher inflation than we have today. And so the value of family allowances was being eroded each year because there was no indexation, no adjustment to take into account inflation. So we identified this as an important issue for our members who had children, and so we started the campaign that family allowances should be increased to the level that they had in terms of real value at the time they were introduced, and secondly, they should be indexed regularly thereafter. And that was a major campaign that we ran, and eventually the Hawke government, to its credit, did increase family allowances, not right back to their original value, but certainly increased them significantly and also provided for their indexation over time. So there was a second income issue that we took up where we were successful. And the third issue that we took up in the 1980s, and again under our family policy, was that the 1980s was a period when the Hawke government, in different ways through what was then known as the Prices and Income Accord with the union movement, put a limit, a ceiling, on the amount of pay rises that people were entitled to get under the award system. And so over time, the real value of people's gross income was declining. So we argued that it was time for a tax cut for low-income workers in order to try to restore the value of their after-tax incomes to the level that they previously had. And again, we ran a major campaign on that issue, and eventually the Hawke government conceded the point, and there was a significant tax cut, which had a significant impact on the take-home pay for low-income workers. So in the 1980s, our family policy led us to be campaigning on issues of family income. That brings me then to the 1990s. And again, there were, in my mind, three standout issues during the 1990s, but they were different. They weren't about family income. They were about the family itself. The first one was that in the early 1990s, the United Nations declared a particular year, I can't remember which one it was, but it was about 1992 or 93 or maybe 94, the year of the family. This was to be the year of the family. And it seemed to us that this was a good year to be campaigning on family issues. Paul Keating said publicly, "This is not the time to define what we mean by family." But we thought, no, that's wrong. This is the time to start talking about what we mean by family and by what we would like family to be. Because all the research in the Western world, in a range of different countries, that was being done at that time showed that where there is family breakdown and where people divorce and where children are growing up in single-income families, those children do materially and significantly worse in their education, in their psychological development, and in a whole range of other measures compared with where children are raised by their married mother and father. All the research was pointing in that direction. It was so obvious at that time in the 1990s that even President Bill Clinton, who, as we know, wasn't an angel when it came to his personal life, publicly appealed to American males and particularly American black males to stay with their families while their children were growing up because the consequences of their absence were so dramatic. Even Bill Clinton said that. So we said, this is the time to say something about the family. And so we started to talk about the family based on marriage. Very significant development. The second thing that occurred in the 1990s was that there was a joint parliamentary committee of the federal parliament, which in 1995 had been looking at the issue of the cost of marital breakdown. So this is a different aspect of the breakdown of marriage. The cost to the federal budget of supporting people where a marriage had been broken up. And they came to the conclusion that at that time, the cost to revenue was over $10 billion a year and growing rapidly. And so this parliamentary committee, made up of both Labor and Coalition members, recommended to the government unanimously. There was no dissent on this issue. They recommended a number of ways in which the government should support marriage in order to try to put a lid on the cost of family breakdown, to try to support people and assist people to keep marriages intact before they reached the point where there was the inevitable breakdown. Now, we supported that. The committee made its recommendations in 1995. Early the following year, John Howard was elected into government, and the chair of that parliamentary committee, Kevin Andrews, became a minister in the Howard government. And I remember going to see him at the time to say, and introducing myself because I didn't know him, of saying to him, we support the recommendations of your committee and we support any efforts that you make to implement the recommendations about support for marriage in order to try to keep marriages together. He thanked me very much for that. He was very surprised. He did try to implement some of the recommendations. Unfortunately, the Labor Party members on the committee who had unanimously supported the recommendations changed their mind, and I include Wayne Swan in this, and they opposed the changes which Kevin Andrews tried to put through, and they finished up not getting very far because they were blocked in the Senate. The third issue that came up in the 1990s was in about 1999. In Victoria, IVF had become available in the 1980s, and the Labor government had legislated that IVF should only be available where there was a man and a woman, not necessarily married, but in a stable relationship. In other words, IVF was not available to single women. There was a single woman in Victoria who wanted to access IVF. So she wanted to become pregnant and to have a child in an environment where there would be no father. And obviously, the law prevented that. The law prescribed very clearly there had to be a man in a stable relationship with a woman in order for IVF to be accessed. So she must have got legal advice, and she went to the federal court arguing that she was being discriminated against by this federal, by this state law under the Federal Anti-Discrimination Act. And the judge of the federal court came out with his decision finding in her favour, which meant that from that point on, single women were entitled to access IVF and therefore to raise children without there ever being a father in prospect. Now, this story broke in the middle of a Labor Party national conference. And the media went to Kim Beazley, who was then the parliamentary leader, and they asked him what his view was. And he said, well, I agree with that. I agree with the judge's decision. They then came to me. Now, I sort of hadn't really hit the national scene as a controversial person up until that stage. But they asked me my view, and I said I disagreed. And this became a very big issue. It finished up being argued out at the National Executive of the Labor Party, which is a body then and now of 21 people. And it was argued out over several hours. It was a long debate. I think I spoke for 3/4 of an hour on the issue. It went on and on and on. All of the people on the left were in favour of the federal court decision. All the people on the centre-left were in favour of the federal court decision, and Kim Beazley was as well, and he's one of the 21. That left the 9 people on the right. 7 out of the 9 supported my point of view. That was quite remarkable. The two who did not support me were the two New South Wales right-wing Labor Party representatives. And they took the attitude, you never vote against the leader. Now, I think that was a big mistake they made, but that's how they voted. So the issue was lost. The Labor Party clearly went the other way. But one good thing did come out of that, and that was because this had been such a divisive issue, on an issue of moral beliefs and conscience, the Labor Party set up a body to look at conscience voting in the Labor Party, and I was one of the two people who did the investigation. The other one was Senator John Faulkner. And we came back with a report which argued that the Labor Party should be generous in providing a conscience vote to its members in federal and state parliaments on these sorts of issues. They were not limited to life issues, as some people sometimes say, but moral issues that deeply concern people. And so the practice ever since, for the past 15 years, has been that if a parliamentary Labor Party at the state or federal level is asked for a conscience vote by one or more of its members and refuses, they can bring it to the ALP National Executive and it will decide the issue and, if necessary, override the state parliamentary party. And that's the way it has worked ever since. Since that time, no Labor member has ever come to me asking for a conscience vote where I have not been able to deliver it through the ALP National Executive. And on two occasions, state parliamentary parties in that 15 years have been overridden by the National Executive and granted a conscience vote. So that was a good thing that came out of that whole debate. But for us as a union and our family policy, we now found ourselves totally at odds with where the law of the country had gone, where for the first time, women could use IVF to conceive children and start to raise them without there ever being any father for those children as they grew up. So that brings me to the 2000s. And this has really been a story about same-sex marriage. The first country that introduced same-sex marriage was the Netherlands. And that's the country in which I was born. It introduced same-sex marriage in about the year 2000. Our laws on marriage at that time did not define what marriage was, because it was so obvious. It's between a man and a woman, to the exclusion of all others, voluntarily entered into for life. Everybody knew that. It was, didn't require a definition. But by 2004, there was sufficient talk about same-sex marriage for people to go to the Howard government and ask for a definition to be put into the relevant federal legislation. And when that was proposed, it was basically unanimously supported by both the Coalition and by the Labor Party. The Shadow Attorney General at the time, Nicola Roxon, stood in front of a large meeting of family representatives in the Great Hall of Parliament House and committed the Labor Party to supporting this definition of marriage as being between a man and a woman, to the exclusion of all others, voluntarily entered into for life. And Labor members in the Parliament unanimously supported that, 2004. That definition of marriage then found its way into the Labor Party platform. Not through our doing, but it found its way into the platform because that was the party policy. And we decided that we as a union, having a family policy, should adopt the same thing, that marriage was between a man and a woman. Slowly but surely, however, the campaign for same-sex marriage started to crank up. And then in the 2010 election campaign, when Julia Gillard had just taken over from Kevin Rudd, she was asked during the campaign, what is the Labor Party's policy on same-sex marriage? And she decided that consistent with what was in the platform, that she would make a promise that the Labor Party was committed to marriage being between a man and a woman and would not change the law. And she won the election, narrowly, just. She formed a government with independence. And that government did last for 3 years. And I have to say that during that whole time, she consistently stuck by that particular promise that she had made. She is criticised for having broken other promises. The carbon tax comes to mind. But on this issue, she never, ever deviated. However, there were people in the Labor Party who became increasingly unhappy with the policy and they wanted to see it change. So it came up at the Labor Party National Conference in December 2011, which was held here in Sydney. And there was obviously a big debate in the whole period leading up to the conference. During that time, by virtue of being the only one, I think, prepared to do it, I took the lead in defending the existing policy. And I spoke to Julia Gillard several times in the period leading up to the conference, and asking her to give her support in every way she possibly could to ensure that the policy wasn't changed. And I have to say that she did absolutely everything I asked of her. On the eve of the conference, as we were counting the numbers, as you do in the Labor Party, but also I think in the coalition parties, of the 400 delegates who go to a Labor Party national conference, on the eve of the conference, we were about 8 votes short. And that was after people having their arms twisted, persuaded in every way possible, the Prime Minister effectively putting her authority on the line. We couldn't get the numbers. We could not get the numbers. The majority was there for a change. At the same time, the people who were wanting to change the policy also were very clear they didn't want a conscience vote on the issue. And so the final argument became, could a conscience vote be retained on this issue? And very narrowly it was. On the policy issue, there was just, in the end, overwhelming support. Because once it became apparent that the policy was going to change, many of those who had been persuaded to vote against it in effect went the way they wanted to go, which was to support it. I was the only national union leader in the country that was against it. Every other union leader in this country, whether they were left or right or anywhere in between, was against it. Well, was in favour of same-sex marriage and therefore in favour of a change in the policy. But the conscience vote was retained. Now, of course, people from the Labor Party who had supported the change were jubilant. And as soon as they got back into Parliament in 2012, they were putting together resolutions in order to change the legislation. So in 2012, there was a vote on same-sex marriage. But the Coalition didn't allow a conscience vote, and the Labor Party did. And so significant numbers of Labor Party members voted against changing the law. And so a substantial majority in both the House of Representatives and the Senate rejected any change. Now, this really enraged the people who wanted change. So they started to demand that the Coalition allow a conscience vote, and at the same time, they started to demand that the Labor Party get rid of its conscience vote. Great consistency here. But that's what they did, because they realised that a conscience vote would mean a number of Coalition people who would vote in favour of a change. And by denying a conscience vote in the Labor Party, those people who had exercised the conscience vote would, in their view, not be allowed to do it again. And therefore, that would increase the vote in favour of a change. And so that's what they campaigned for. And so the issue of the conscience vote came up at the Labor Party conference in July, just a month ago, when the Labor Party conference met in Melbourne. Again, in the period leading up to that Labor Party conference, I was talking to Bill Shorten about it, and he made it very clear that, again, he was prepared to put his authority on the line to retain the conscience vote. And again, he worked hard to try to secure the retention of the conscience vote. But on the third day of the conference, when the issue was to be determined, he found, and this was by common consent of all the number counters, the numbers weren't there to retain a conscience vote. The numbers simply weren't there. We were again about 10 or 12 votes short out of the 400. And so people started to talk about what might go through. Now, the Penny Wongs and the Tanya Plibersek's and so on, they wanted the conscience vote to be taken away immediately by, I think, good negotiation. What we ultimately achieved was a situation where the conscience vote would remain for all of the current term of the Federal Parliament and all of the next term of the Federal Parliament, and only after that, which will be late 2019 if parliaments run their normal term, only at the end of 2019 will the conscience vote on that issue be taken away. So that's where we finished up. It was on that day, in July last month, the common view among the small group who put this together that there was basically zero chance that same-sex marriage would not have been introduced by the end of the next term of the Parliament. After last week in the Coalition, I'm not so sure, but at that time, the common judgment was we were gone on the issue. If so many countries in the Western world, in one way or another, had changed their policy, including even our cousins across the ditch, New Zealand, under a Conservative government, it was simply unreasonable to expect that at some point it won't happen here. Whether it will or whether it won't, I don't know. What I do know is this, that if the issue comes up at the time of the expiry of the conscience vote, and the conscience vote is not restored, there will still be Labor members in the parliament who will cross the floor, because they're not going to allow the law of this country to be changed in a way they fundamentally disagree with, irrespective of what the consequences are for them. And if I was in the parliament, which I'm not, I'd be the first one across the floor. Now, in conclusion, can I ask you to reflect on three issues which are staring us in the face, particularly if same-sex marriage is introduced. The first is that we are clearly saying as a society that we accept that children will be raised in families either without a father or without a mother. Their right to be raised by a father and a mother will disappear, because we, the adults, are imposing that on them. And there will be consequences on their development as a result of what we impose on them. So take the case of two ladies who live together. If they want children, they will use a man somewhere who is a donor. And presumably, one of the two ladies will become pregnant. So she becomes the natural mother of the child. The biological father has no role in that child's development and education and growing up to adulthood whatsoever. And there is a second mother in the household as well. If you take two men, and there was a story about this in this morning's Age newspaper, and presumably it was in the Sydney Morning Herald as well, two men who claim to be married under laws in the United States are in Thailand trying to collect a daughter that has been born to a surrogate mother in Thailand. That's the story. And the birth mother, the egg was donated by somebody else. It was implanted in the surrogate woman. So the egg came from the biological mother. The woman who gave birth to the child and carried it to the point of birth is the birth mother. She doesn't want to give it up, because she says, now, whatever she entered into in terms of a contract with the two men, she says, now, this is not a natural family, and I'm not going to give this child, which has been born to me, up to be raised in that sort of a family. And the two men are most unhappy that a daughter that they thought they had achieved through this surrogacy is now not going to be given to them. At least that's where the story is as of this morning. So again, they're proposing that this daughter be raised by the two men. I presume one of them is the biological father, but in an environment where she will never know her birth mother or her biological mother. So this is what we are imposing as a society on a proportion of our children going into the future. The second thing is, of course, surrogacy. Now, a few years ago, there was a debate in the West Australian Parliament to permit surrogacy, and now this has become very common. Surrogacy basically means that children are treated as a commodity. I was raised anyway, and I presume everybody else here is as well, raised to understand that children are a gift from God. I have four gifts from God. And it is the most amazing thing that you have these gifts from God, these children. But now children are a commodity. if adults decide, I want a child, they must get one in one way or another. And if I can't have children naturally, then I'll find some other way of doing it. Is it whether it be IVF or surrogacy? I'll find another way because I want a child and whatever I want, I must have. And the third issue is the issue of religious freedom. If same-sex marriage becomes the law of the land, how can our schools teach what marriage is? Because the teaching on marriage of the Christian church will be contrary to what the law provides. Now, there are many examples overseas where people who have not accepted same-sex marriage are discriminated against in various ways because of the law having been changed and same-sex marriage having been introduced. And that will happen here. So religious freedom is at stake on this issue. And while it will still be possible for a person with religious beliefs to hold those beliefs in their own narrow little environment and perhaps to express them inside the four walls of a church or wherever, the public sphere will no longer be available to express religious beliefs. Canada is the worst example of this, where for the past decade or more, there have been many examples of where judges in courts and various human rights or anti-discrimination tribunals have issued rulings against people who have held and expressed their view that they are opposed to same-sex marriage and its consequences, and the same thing will happen here. So I've tried to explain how the union as an organisation appointed a national women's officer, developed a family policy as a result of talking to our women members, which started off expressing itself on issues of family income and then moved to the family and the importance of marriage in having intact families which operate to the benefit of all members of the family, to the point where we have opposed same-sex marriage. A logical development over 40 years to where we are today. And we are the only organisation in the labour movement that still holds that that view. And there are very few people outside the umbrella of this union, the largest union in the country, who have a different view, who have the same view as us. Everybody else, basically outside the umbrella of the SDA, is in the camp of supporting same-sex marriage. So thank you very much.
That was Joe DeBruyne with Family and Work in 21st Century Australia. This talk was hosted by the St. Thomas More Society and the Maronite Lawyers Guild. And for more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.